You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 482, packed with four, count them, four members. And we got some new people. We got some old people. We're going to be hitting the new stories, the old stories, fire. We're going to be hitting John Barbado selling expensive t-shirts. We're going to be hitting Green Day. We're going to be hitting Ian MacKay back in the saddle again. Punk News Podcast 482. Let's get rocking. Punk News Podcast number 482. We've got a new face or a new voice joining us today, so we're excited about that. But before we get to that, let's talk to some of the old heads. First of all, we are here with Matt. Adam, are you mad? No, you're not managing editor now. You're contributing editor. Contributing editor, Adam White. Adam, how's the contributions going these days?
What, for me? I mean, minimal. I forcefully demoted myself so I don't have to take responsibility for anything that anyone else does, and that's just working out fine.
All right, then. Well, listen, responsibility is not punk, as they say. We're also here with Tom Trauma, who's been on the podcast, I don't know, now 5 years maybe. He's been writing for the site 6 or 7. Tom, how long have you been on the podcast for?
Oh, probably all 5 years off and on. I was kind of a fill-in, and then when Ricky retired at the, you know, ripe old age of 27 or whatever, they decided to replace, you know, we replaced him with an older model. And so it's been over about a year now that I've been most kind of the regular. So, but you know what? Maybe we have a new contender to knock me out again. Get me back to my part-time status. We'll see.
We've got a new contender here to shake things up and distress us and cause us problems, but also really help re-energize the site. We've got the newest editor at Punk News, M. Moore, who is doing a fantastic job covering the new stuff, the old stuff, and it was really, really, you know, making me look bad, which is good. You know, I think Em is contributing more news stories than anybody, and she's got a great broad range. Em, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Thank you. Really nice to be here. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Just so the listeners know, Em is up in Canada too, so we've got another person from the Canadian faction. So we've got that. We've got two Americans, two Canadians battling right now. Just so the listeners can learn a little bit about you, like what's your deal? Like, what do you do? What are you into? What's kicking?
Well, I'm 20 years old. I learned today that the Punk News is older than I am, so that's fun. I just really like punk music. That was the main reason. I've been reading the site for about 5 years or so, and last year started writing reviews and haven't looked back since.
Well, fantastic. Well, M, thanks for joining in. Thanks for helping us out. And we'll jump into the mail, and then we'll play.
So M, you're 20. Like, I have my oldest son is 20 also.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I have two kids in college. So did your parents listen to good music?
Lots of metal. So I grew up with Dio.
It's better than like Engelbert Humperdinck or something, right? Ooh,
there was that too, but we don't talk about that.
Dio, huh?
Yeah.
But not punk necessarily.
Not really. No,
that would make sense. If your parents are in their like mid to late 40s, that would make them, you know, probably growing up in the peak era of like hair metal like I did. So nothing to be ashamed of there.
All good bands.
Exactly.
Still, well, mostly good band.
Still better than Newfound Glory.
Well, here we are on the road again. as the famous Whitesnake song, that's Adam and Mine theme song. You can always reset
podcast. Willie Nelson there, Johnny. Road again is Willie Nelson.
On the road again is here I go again on the road again. That's Whitesnake. I've wasted my time.
I don't believe on the road again is ever mentioned in the Whitesnake song. Em would know because her parents used to play it every day when she was a kid.
Dear podcast, Dear podcast, I've always loved the podcast. I've been listening since Dante was the host. I have to say, I'm sorry that I won't be hearing you anymore, being as though you criticized Scientology. I can only guess that your days are numbered. It was a good run. And that's from Bill.
Prepare to have your dog poisoned.
Bill, thanks for writing in. This is from Brett.
Well, hold on. You've gotten in this, like, rush through the news and don't let us react to it habit or through the mail, John. No. Slow down.
Okay, Adam, what's your opinion on Scientology?
I don't know if they can cross the border, so it's okay. But the
I'm sure there's some up there.
No, there's one in Ottawa, right on Rideau Street.
Tom Cruise knows no borders. He can right up there and smack you around.
I want to give a shout out here to mentioning Dante. That was like how that was.
I also remember Dante. That was a long time ago.
I don't even have a proper recollection of how many shows we did with that lineup of people, like even predating me, right? Like when it was like Dante and Brian that were doing it. So
it was Dante, Brian, and Chris Moran. That was about the first 50 episodes.
Yeah, shit. That's
I remember when John was like me at like 2 years ago, where John was like the once a month guy.
He started
creeping in, and then he took over, and now I took over, and now John and I's master plan is all falling into place.
The first time I was on the Punkish podcast was I specifically requested to be on just for one segment, but I ended up being on the whole thing, and that was when Harley Flanagan got in an altercation at CBGB's at the Cro-Mag show.
A little stabbing.
If you go back and listen to my perspective then and my perspective now, it just goes to show people can change to an incredible distance, if you will.
All right. You may continue, sir.
All right. Anything else you want to say about Scientology or Dante, Adam?
Scientology is the one true faith.
All right. This is from Brett.
Tom Cruise's tears cure cancer.
Brett.
Sorry, go ahead.
Brett says, how old is too old to stop going to shows, or at least small shows? I know Aerosmith has geezers like us in the audience, but I've been going to shows at my local quote-unquote punk dive, the Tropical Heat Bar, and people are looking at me like I'm a dead guy. All right? It's getting to the point where my self-awareness is making me not have any fun. Should I pack it in? Should I only go to old man shows? And this is from Brett.
Well, you should never stop going to the old man shows because they're great. But I remember specifically going to a show, and I think I wrote a review of it relatively recently. It was Direct Hit. And there were literally four people there over 40, and we all knew each other. And at one point, we were all standing in a neat little line, you know, behind the pit. But no, you should never quit going. I wish I knew how old this guy was.
He didn't say it.
Aerosmith. I mean, please. They just had their like 50th anniversary. No, I'm not going to that crap. Nobody should. But
I mean, it's never stop. It's kind of an art to become like the old show guy, and it's something you have to work on. Like you can't just show up and be there. It is a conscious effort that you have to keep refining and figuring out. Especially because we're in this era where if you're like me and you're starting to become like old show guy who is at the show alone because you know my wife has to watch the kids or whatever, so I'm not going
to
go.
Can relate to that. Right? Also, Adam.
So if you're going to be that guy, it's a weird existence right now because. In the old days, all your problems would have been solved because you could smoke, right? So you would sit there and you would talk to nobody, but you could smoke a cigarette. And then in between bands or whatever, you go stand outside and smoke a cigarette and it would work. Now I'm saying this being someone...
I'm so old, Adam, that you used to be able to do it right inside the venue.
Right now I'm saying this as someone who never smokes or who's never smoked, but I get the appeal. Where you're standing around and you're like, fuck, like if I only, like I have that feeling all the time. Like if I only had a cigarette right now, I would be doing something. And I feel
and
like
only
that's,
the cool, they look so cool, don't they? Only the coolest people are smoking usually.
Right.
I gave it up like 8 years ago. I had to, I still look at the people smoking. I'm sort of jealous. The
right. Conversation so what do you do? I mean, if you're me, you nurse a beer at like a really annoyingly slow rate because you probably have to go somewhere afterwards. But but outside of that, like you don't want to be sitting there looking at your phone the whole time because what a shitty thing.
Phones are the new cigarettes, Adam. I disagree.
Oh, no, I don't want to be the person. I'm super conscious of doing it. So I was at a show not too long ago And I came in and I was clearly like, I was at the show alone and I was the old guy. So I walked in and I like, you know, said hello to the venue owner or the bartender or whoever, because, you know,
he's the only guy there your age.
Right. You got to get to know that person. But then they're working, right? So you can't just stand around and glom onto them because they're the person you know. So I kind of like got my beer and just leaned on this table at the back of the venue. And I thought to myself, I am not going to be the on my phone guy right now. I'm going to be somehow present in the room, yet still not talking to anyone and just leaning on this table. So I'm doing this very consciously. And then some guy who was slightly younger than me that was there to clearly came from like out of town to see the band, but was basically in my exact situation, but didn't know the game of, you know, I'm going to go lean on this table and try to look cool. He wandered over and he was like, hi, I'm Jim. And he started telling me all about his life. And suddenly I'm talking to someone and I'm like, oh, okay. This is how you just like be a person in the room and not be super off-putting about it. And I felt very proud of myself.
But, the problem is like 7% of the time or 80% of those guys, like those guys are total wackos. You know what I mean? But although that can be fun, but it can be exhausting too.
I don't know. I felt very, very good about myself that I somehow didn't look like a maniac enough that some wacko who was feeling equally awkward in a room decided to come talk to me. So I'm just saying that's something I want to work on.
And what's your stance? Do you go to shows by yourself or do you always go with a crew?
I go by myself usually.
So what do you do? You bring?
Hey, when I was 20, I had friends.
So I mean, hey. Do you know people? You go and you know people there. Like, see, in Philadelphia, there's like the Cousin Danny scene and the House of Yaga scene, and people don't go with people generally, but a good number of people know each other there. Is that your situation, or do you just go and hang yourself, hang out by yourself, or what do you do? What's your situation?
I go and hang out by myself usually. Like, I've taken friends in the past, but they don't really the music. So it's just like, okay, well, I'll go. I'll have a good time. You know, I'll try to stay upright and not, you know, go down. So that's kind of that. But yeah, like, people are usually really nice. And you know, you strike up conversations. It's like, oh my god, I love this band, and it's like, you know, you're talking about it, so like it's really fun that way. You meet a lot of good people, but you meet a lot of assholes. But you know,
dragging people to a show that don't want to be there at all is really just like a surefire way to make it worse.
Bad idea.
Like, yeah, because then you feel like you got to leave early.
I remember like when I was in college, we at one point we went from Guelph up to Toronto because we wanted to go see the New Bomb Turks play at the Horseshoe Tavern. And
nice.
And so we got up there and it was like pissing rain and sleet. And it was just like a super shitty day. And I convinced like one of my best friends to go up with me, but like he had no particular context about the bands. And my now wife then girlfriend was up with me and she was sick, and we just like we got there and you could see like both of them did not want to be there listening to that band play at maximum volume to like 12 people in a room. And the whole time I'm just like I couldn't get into anything because I'm just like, oh, I feel horrible that I've made these people come here and suffer in this bar.
But now yeah. You're glad that you got to see the New Bomb Turks.
I am too, but you know.
I see the thing with me. So I've been in the same scene now for a long time. Like we're talking like 30 years. So I have multiple generations of people I'm friendly with. So it's very, very, very rare that I go to a show that I don't run into somebody I can hang out with. So just keep going, whoever you are. And eventually you'll make some friends.
Well, you can watch that podcast at punknews.org. Let's play a song and we'll come back. Who's got a tune to play?
And I've really been slacking off on that.
I'll play a song. Check this out.
Go ahead, John.
So,
let's see if I can find some.
The listeners might laugh at this, but Crass had a contest where you could remix Crass songs, and the winners are going to get put on a record as like the Crass remixes or whatever. And some people remix some tracks by doing a true remix and that just taking the audio levels and changing them or maybe putting on some filters, but doing a true remix. Other people did what the modern remix is, which is kind of like a dance remix, if you will. And the vast majority of people basically just made industrial Crass tracks. And I decided to go the opposite. And I was going to do They Owe Us a Living, but like five people had done that already. So then I was going to do Fight War, Not Wars, but because that's easy to remix. It's just one line. But then, like, someone else had done that. So I did Band from the Roxy. And so I did, like, a factory record style remix of Band from the Roxy. And the high concept, highly pretentious idea I had is, what if Crass, when Band from the Roxy, instead of playing, you know, like, non-traditional venues, decided to go back to the Roxy and sneak in by playing dance music, but keeping their message the same. So this is my, and I'm pretty proud of this. I want to listen to, like, tell me if I just think it's cool because I did it, or actually it's kind of cool. I want their honest opinion. Not that I listen to it, but this is my remix of Band from the Roxy. It's called Crass Band from the Roxy Back to the Roxy Remix. My entry in the Crass Remix Project, and we'll be back.
From the Roxy, okay, I never must apply there anyway. Said I only want it, well behaved, but don't I think a dozen microphones are just fucking toys? Fuck them, try them to make my stand against what I feel is wrong with this land. Just sit there on their other fed asses, feeding off the sweat of less fortunate class. Keep their fucking power, cut their fingers on the bar. Got control, won't let it be forgotten. True to their reality, the wrong ain't ever come. Pivot ain't Belfast, that's no fucking fun. See you in the squatty, lying in the front yard. See you in the machine gun, resting on the fence. Fighting the action, do your rap on those bound. Got a fucking nerve to call it defense. Defense is just a threat of strength. Protection for the privilege that ain't any late. Government protecting their province from the pole. Rich and unfortunate, shining like a dome. Fly down a paper, my ass a little more. Then the shit I get, 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 shit I get. Defense, shit, it's stopping at the wall. And now I'm about a government, knows what the fuck is for. Back from the Roxy, okay. 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 From the Roxy, okay. Back from the Roxy, okay. Say fucking lies with depressing frequency. Say me out of current. Keep my life clean. Who's alive? Who's fucking life? Who the fuck am I talking to? Who's alive? Who's fucking life? Do you want me? It ain't me and you. Systems crash everywhere. School, I'm in church. Cover up the deal. Back to reality, back to fear. Fucking conspiracy, I'm starting to feel it real. Wrong, I got me. Said it fucking wrong. I can't really remark that, but I've done it so. Bands on the rock, see? Okay, never mind supplying it anyway. Bad from the Roxy, okay, never mind supplying it anyway. Bad from the Roxy, okay, never mind supplying it anyway.
God. And that was my remix of Crass's Band from the Roxy. Adam, what'd you think of my remix?
John, it was brilliant, man. Oh yeah.
Thanks. So listen, we got a lot of news to cover this week, and we're already behind, like we're always behind, but that's all right. But we'll hit some of the bigger news stories of the week. Arguably the biggest punk news story of this week, and even of the month, and even of the year, Ian MacKay has given, well, I should say Ian MacKay, Amy Farina, and Joe Lally have given the details for their new bands. As you may recall, a little over a year ago, Ian, Amy, and Joe said, we've got a new band. And I can't remember if they did one show, two shows, or three shows, but they didn't name, they said, we don't have a name yet, and that's all we're doing. Well, they've released not only the name, but they're coming out with a whole album, and they released the first track, and they quote, hope to tour. So we'll see about that. The name of the band, and let me get this right, Kuriki, or maybe Kuriki, or Kuriki. You guys can all tell me how you think.
Always a good sign when you don't know how to pronounce the name.
Corky and the Juice Pigs is.
Ugh.
Anyways, so they've got an album coming out, and the album is called Kuriki or Kuriki or something. That's going to be out March 27th via Discord, and they released the first track. The first track is called Clean Kill. I don't say it was polarizing, but people kind of thought it was cool or just okay. I thought it was pretty cool. To me, it sounded like Evens with a little bit more whap to it, and I like the Evens. So I thought it was cool. I think the name's pretty bad, honestly. And it's funny because Ian's usually pretty good with, like, you know, Minor Threat, great name. You know, Teen Idols, pretty good name. Fugazi, great name. Even the Evens is an okay name, but like Kuriki, like, I don't know what that is. Adam, what's a Kuriki?
I don't know, and it's been bothering me all day because
like a Paul Hogan, like Crikey.
That's what I was going to say, a mispronunciation of the Crocodile Hunter or something.
It is an awkwardly, it's one of those words that my stupid joke aside, like I keep wanting to say Corky, and that can't be what it is.
Oh,
and,
from Northern Exposure or whatever?
It's like the
special kid from that TV show from the 90s.
It's a phonetically strange name, and if they were to come out tomorrow and say, you know, look, we goofed and we've renamed the band, I don't think I would fault them for it at all. I'd be like, that's okay. I mean, you're Ian MacKay, you get a mulligan on this one. I don't know. I mean, sonically, I'm into this. Now, I'm on record as not liking the Evens, or at least being, let's say, like aggressively indifferent to the Evens. But I really loved The Argument, the last Fugazi record, and this has a little bit of that vibe, at least to my ear, which I'm down with. So. I'm okay with Ian making, you know, softer, more thoughtful, but, like, you know, maybe slightly sinister sounding rock music. I'm good with that. I'm curious to see, like, where they go from this and what kind of dynamics are on this record. Like, does this band get particularly loud at all? Is something I'd be curious about, but you know, one in, I'm down. I can't abide the name.
Crikey.
It was like, could you get the t-shirt? They're not selling them, but because it's them, but like, could you walk around with a t-shirt on?
No, they'll sell them. They'll just only be $12.
That's not a knife. This is a knife.
This is not a Crikey t-shirt. Yeah, I don't know.
Tom, are you a Paul Hogan fan?
I would rather listen to Paul Hogan than a new band with Ian and his wife.
Really?
I am not an Evens fan, and I might be the only person in America who's not even slightly excited about this band. I am prepared to be fully disappointed with this and or not even give it a chance.
I do not like Evens. Excited.
I think the Evens are a below average band, a bad band even. But
what?
But Ian has so much goodwill in the punk rock community that for some reason they listen to this and say, okay, it's good, and it's just not. So
good night.
Sorry, Alex, going to bed. I'm left you speechless. I like that. It's I don't know. I mean, I'll give it a quick spin, but I don't think it's gonna be any good.
And the name Kuriki, what do you think? That's a cool name, or do you think it's odd and hard to say and not the good name?
No, I think they're fucking with you. Like, I think that's the whole point of the name of it. Like, I don't know. Like, if there's that much, like, that goes into how do you even say it? You know, they're distracting.
From the awful music?
They're shifting focus. Your
away
words.
From the awful music?
and do you think it's kind of like the same thing with Fugazi? I mean, Fugazi actually does have a meaning, but like in the context of the band, like it doesn't have a meaning, and so they're doing that so you don't imply anything. And actually, let's talk about that for a brief second. So two-part question, Em. Do you think they're using Koraiki because it has no meaning, therefore one has no preconceived notions? But then is there value to preconceived notions, you know, in a band, like The Clash or like Gwar? You know, is there value to have a name that suggests what you are?
I think that what they're doing with not like, if, you know, Koraiki or however you say it, doesn't have a meaning, like, I think that that is going to work for them, because it's like, oh, what's this? This is new. This is different. This is weird. And then the only thing that you have really, like what it would just be like Ian's involvement in it. And then it'd be like, oh, well, you know, Fugazi and the Evens and all that business, you know, like kind of tying that in. But I think a lot can be said about band names, because if you hear like a band name, like just for instance, like Violent Party, you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to have like really good like music, and they might sound like kind of, you know, hardcore and very like anger, like aggressive and stuff. You know, and if like they live up to that, then it's like, okay, good. That's a good name. And if they don't, then you're disappointed, even though they didn't promise that in the name. You know what I mean? So I think like the preconceived notion can go either way.
Well said. Let's talk about a band whose name.
This is definitely a blank slate. I will give them that for the name.
Yeah, I'm already imagining them in like those wicker hats, you know, with vests.
I mean, if they called the band Crushed Skull, people would be super disappointed at their wimpy music. So at least this way, it's sort of a blank canvas.
See, I love it when a band like names themselves the opposite of what they are, too. You know what I mean?
That's ironic, like, hipster talk, John.
I wouldn't say it's ironic. Like the Birthday Party. Like I wouldn't say that's ironic hipster.
Oh, like 30s before, because they were like, because it sounded like pipes banging and so on. Yeah,
right. But speaking of a band that has used their name to not only define them, but act as a quick branding device, Leftover Crack, they are going on tour very soon. And suddenly, and a lot of people are surprised that they announced the tour basically starting in 2 weeks. Leftover Crack has got a massive spring tour, and actually they've got a bunch of show dates in about 2 weeks from now. However, they also have announced four releases. Here are the releases Leftover Crack's going to release. They're going to release outtakes of Constructs of the State, which will include about 8 tracks, including one track recorded with Eric Peterson of Mischief Brew, who has now sadly passed away. They're going to release a split EP with Days and Days, where they each cover each other's songs and each do one song. They're going to release a new album, Leftover Crack 4, tentatively titled. And the Choking Victim Live album is going to come out, but not out on Fat Records, out on some other label. And who knows? So the point being is this Leftover Crack regrouping and really coming back firing on all cylinders? Or is this the rantings of a madman that has no idea what he's doing? And I will point out that most people kind of assume Leftover Crack was petering out about 3 years ago, but then they came out with the album Constructs of the State, which is an excellent, excellent album. I don't think I'd say it's their best, but I would say it was surprisingly good and arguably their second best. So Leftover Crack, what's the status? What can we expect? What are people hoping for? And also, what's the deal with Fat? You know, like what happened there?
Because originally, Fuck World Trade originally was on like Alternative Tentacles, right? And then it was reissued on.
Was that the one that was
split? Am I right about that?
No, you're right. F World Trade was on Alternative Tentacles. Then Deadline was on Alternative Tentacles vinyl wise and Fat Records CD wise, and then Construct.
But I remember the reissue was on Fat Rec.
Correct.
So, like, I think they had a falling out with. Is it possible these guys just have a falling out with every label they're involved with?
Well, they do have a not a great track record. Hellcat, Bankshot, Fat.
Everybody's screwing them. Everybody's screwing them. Because you don't hear a lot of people talk poorly about Fat. And they're not talking. I haven't heard any talk, but I'm just saying it's unusual for a band to leave them.
Actually, I can think of – actually, he was quite frank about it. Black Dahlia is the only guy that I can think of that has talked poorly about Fat.
But they never put out a full length on Fat.
They put out a 7-inch, and then the story, and I can't verify this or not, but the story was that they asked Blag to put out another 7-inch, and Blag assembled the art and the track list And then Blagg sent it over and they said, oh, we can't put out this. And Blagg was particularly miffed because he's like, you asked me to make it this way, you know? So,
yeah.
So
interesting.
And leftover crack, is that your style or not your style? Where do you stand on leftover crack?
I like them. They're good. Oh.
So, they're one of my favorite bands. The four releases. Are you excited or are you somewhat troubled by this massive swing? You know, like if they were pressing, we're going to put out an album. It'd be like, oh, that's awesome, you know. But they're like, oh, we're going to put out four albums. And you're like, what are you thinking?
It's a bit overwhelming, but like, you know, overall, like I think they're all going to be like decent to good. You know, I don't think they're gonna like drop the ball on anything, so I'm excited for them. I really liked Constructs, so like I want to know like you know, the other recorded stuff that they didn't release. I want to hear that because I think that's going to be really good. And like The Split's going to be good, probably.
Do you like Days and Days? Have you heard them?
Well, you know how if someone... Well, how we were talking earlier about the names of things, how you have, like, connotations. When I hear folk punk, I tend to steer away. You know?
You and me both. It spans the generations, Adam.
Good to hear.
Adam, what's your stance on Leftover Crack 2020? Is there statements left to be made? Is this a bold statement, or is this, you know, are we entering in classic era Nick Blinko territory?
On the one hand, I appreciate Stizza just kind of out there doing whatever he wants without regard for the marketability of it. I mean, that's kind of nice. On the other hand, am I wrong that Leftover Crack, like independent of the band's own choice in the matter, are they not one of these bands where people will slavishly buy whatever they put out? Like, are they not one of these bands that is for, like, for lack of any better term for it, like a brand band where,
I would say that's somewhat reductive. I mean, like, I think most of the stuff they put out is very carefully considered, and I don't think the kind of band that would just put out I know they're not the kind of band that just puts out junk to sell it.
Well, not that they would put out junk to sell it, but that they could put out whatever pops into their artistic maw at the given moment, and there's like a certain stripe of, like, you know, fans of that crack rock steady sound that are going to just like slavishly eat it up no matter what.
Could you say the same thing about like Lou Reed? I mean, like, no one ever says, but Lou Reed's got a lot of bad albums.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there was I was really into the Leftover Crack thing back in my like my Hellcat devotee years, right? But I feel like there was a point when, and this isn't even Leftover Crack's fault really, but there was a point where all of a sudden you had all of those similar sounding bands that cropped cropped up on labels like maybe like Bankshot and things like that at the time. Like, what was that one? No Cash, you remember?
The band was Low Cash, but not Low Cash.
No Cash. I don't know. But like, there were bands that all of a sudden started to crop up, and there's a handful of them like in Niagara that I've heard in the past few years where these bands were basically, they've taken Leftover Crack to the point where they're almost mimicking Stizza's vocals, and they've made that a genre. And I feel like it must be working for them because I keep hearing bands like that, and I'm not sure how to take it, but it's weirded me out on the whole. It's weirded me out on the original, where I'm never sure what to think, because I don't know if I'm down with this like weird, you know, like I don't know, juggalo following that has emerged for that sound. So I don't know what to do with Leftover Crack news at this point. Like, I'm worried I'm gonna dive into one of these records and I'm gonna end up in some sort of weird scene that I wasn't intending to be in.
So you think that if you listen to Leftover Crack, you might become like a train hopper?
I don't know. Or all the train hoppers are going to show up at my house, but they're going to have their like far worse train hopper knockoff bands that I'm going to have to deal with. And I don't know that.
That's the thing is I love Leftover Crack. I love Sublime, but I can't stand Slightly Stupid. You know what I mean? It's like.
Yeah, like, that's exactly it. And it's unfair because I shouldn't judge a band on like the kind of like weird wake that they've left behind them. But I'm kind of doing that.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. And the Leftover Crack ripoff bands are horrible. But I'm a big Leftover Crack fan. I'm excited.
Adam's afraid that he's been experimenting with a certain gateway drug lately, and he might just find himself hooked on crack, I think.
That's my main concern of all the things going on.
Adam, you put that wacky tobacco in your mouth. You'll put anything in there, probably.
Well, speaking of ripoffs, John Varvatos is now selling a line of Misfits clothing. You can buy a John Varvatos branded Misfits t-shirt for $118, which pretty much looks identical to the regular Misfits t-shirt, but it says John Varvatos on it. You can buy a field jacket for $500, or you can buy a leather jacket, which admittedly looks kind of cool, but it's $1,000. And it's basically just a black leather jacket with the Misfits Crimson Ghost spray painted on the back. This is not the first time this phenomenon has happened. For a while, Barney's of New York was selling Black Flag t-shirts for $285. There was that quick fad where somebody was spray painting Against Me on leather jackets and selling them for like $6,000 each. And so we've seen this phenomenon happen before. And for me, there's two main questions here, and I don't know which one of you want to ask this first. The first question is anybody actually buying a $1,000 Misfits jacket or even a $118 Misfits t-shirt? Or is he just putting that up there and that gets people to be aware of the brand and he's not really selling hardly any of them? And the second question is, and this was brought up by one of the readers, and I was actually mad at myself for not having thought of this, is does John Varvatos and does the Misfits even have the intellectual property? Do they own the intellectual property of the Crimson Ghost? Because, of course, the Crimson Ghost is from a movie
rip-off.
The Crimson Ghost from like 1946 or whatever. And I've got a hypothesis for that. But I'll let you guys kick in first before I answer the burning question of the ownership of the Crimson Ghost.
I feel like I've got this sorted out. So it feels like every day now we are getting closer and closer to the point where we are going to eat the rich, right? So these clothing vendors are not selling these $1,000 Misfits jackets or whatever they are to allow these people to be cool. They're selling them to them as protection so that you can venture out onto the streets after society collapses and you look like you're just one of the punks listening to the Misfits, right? Because you bought this jacket. But really, it's just there to keep you from getting eaten. That's what I think it is. And if you're trying to weigh it against, you know, am I going to get eaten today? Then $1,000 is cheap. So that's my theory.
I think this is just this is the three times a year story that we've covered. Not John Varvatos necessarily, but it's always these stories are constantly popping up. And I just can't imagine who's buying this stuff. And let's face it, real punks make their own clothes.
I don't think I don't think they're marketing this towards punks at all. Do you?
No, I mean, I like today at work during a little downtime was looking at new back patches. I mean, you got to make your own stuff, kids. Buy that Dickie shirt. Buy that denim jacket at Goodwill. Put some patches on it. Cut the sleeves off it. You gotta do your own flavor. Screw this thing.
And do you think punks are buying this? Do you think like high end fashion people are buying it as sort of like, remember for hot many people wearing like Iron Maiden t-shirts? Or is this all like a big faux thing and no one's actually buying it? It's really just a marketing ploy.
Well, yeah, I think they're trying to do the whole Kardashian thing, you know, like with the Slayer shirts and stuff. And it's not going to work. It's so stupid because, like, sure, they look cool or whatever, but why would you spend that much money on them? You can get them at thrift stores. You can get them, like, wherever. You know, if you're at, you should have to prove that you're a fan of a band before you buy their merch or shirt or make it or whatever. You know, you should have, like, the 5-song test You know, like, can you name at least five songs that aren't popular?
Wait, Am, that sounds like something an old person would say. But I'm I agree with you in principle, but it's an impractical standard, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. There's been too many things where it's like, oh, you like this band? And it's like, no.
Misfits, Ramones, Nirvana. You know, some of these bands have become so ubiquitous with just pop culture that
you can't really hold
anybody to any standard, hardly.
When I interviewed Linda Ramone, I said, Linda, what do you think of the fact that people wear the shirts and might not know what it is? And her answer was, I think it's great. Anything that promotes the message in any way, I'm a fan of. Now, obviously, she's making money off that.
Anything that gets me royalties in any way, I'm a fan of.
I mean, but then in contrast, I remember when David Beckham was wearing a Crash shirt, Penny Rimbaud said, I could have strangled him, which I thought was hilarious, you know, so. Anyways,
I'm sure that's what he listens to at home.
Yeah, well, as to the question of the ownership of the Crimson Ghost, I don't know the answer, but it's probably one of two things. A, it could be that the Crimson Ghost actually one of three things. It could be that the Crimson Ghost lapsed into public domain because Crimson Ghost is before 1976 Copyright Act, and before the 1976 Copyright Act, it was much easier for things to fall into public domain than it is now. So maybe it is public domain, meaning anybody can use it. But then that means that John Varvatos, if it is public domain, wouldn't have to pay Danzig for the skull because anybody can use it, hypothetically. Nope. But actually,
you think Danzig and Jerry only paid the studio that created it originally?
Well, actually, nope. The answer is yes, I do, and here's why.
Really?
Yes, because Caroline, which is a larger independent record label, distributed Misfit stuff. They're not dummies. Yep. They know that if this product becomes popular and if it's got a copyright infringement right on it, they're going to get mega hit by the owner of this property, which probably isn't even worth that much, really. So my guess, if I had to bet, I would say in the late 80s, Caroline licensed the use of the skull on behalf of the Misfits or made the Misfits license it themselves. The third option, which I would say is equally likely, but I think it's probably the second. The third is that this movie goes back to 1946. The studio that produced it has been out of business for about 70 years, right? Somebody owns the Crimson Ghost imagery, but that person might not know who they are. You see what I'm saying? Because
a bigger company. Yeah.
When that company went out of business, somebody either bought the assets or the assets reverted to whoever it was, the stockholders in that company, right? That person might not even know who they are. You know,
the owner may have died without even selling it. Who knows?
That person is probably deceased, which means it would have passed to their heirs. So quite amusingly, there might be somebody out there that has a multi-million-dollar copyright infringement case in their palm and they don't even know it.
So this is the part of the show, Em, I don't know how many podcasts you've listened to, but this is the part of the show where John and I talk about Danzig stuff, which we do at least every other week. But here's the thing, John. The reason I don't believe or don't have any reason to believe that they had paid for any kind of rights to use that, because Danzig is notorious for using things, stealing things almost wholesale without giving any credit for it.
That's true, but I mean,
even the Danzig skull is a ripoff of an old comic.
Crystal issue 4.
Yeah, and he did a song on his first album called The Hunter, which was written by somebody else. And
Robert Johnson, the blues man who sold his soul to the devil.
Was it Robert Johnson? I thought it was the guys who wrote a lot of Elvis's songs. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, he's credited the song to himself in the record.
Yeah, I think he got sued that. And actually, I think
he did. And the newer pressings actually do have. But, you know, I mean, he's from the Jimmy Page school. Jimmy Page blatantly ripped off all those old blues guys. And it wasn't until the 80s. That they finally were able to sue him and get credit for the songs that he just wholesale ripped off from them.
I don't know if you can I don't know if you can totally blame Jimmy Page for that, because the theme of the blues is that you take an older song and play it yourself. And a lot of these songs, nobody knows who wrote them. And so
but you don't put Plant Page on it then, right?
Well, actually you might, because for example, Hellhound on My Trail. Did Robert Johnson write Hellhound on My Trail? Probably not. That song probably goes back to the 1700s or more, you know. Mm. But he puts Robert Johnson on it because it's the Robert Johnson version. So I'm not saying Jimmy Page and Robert Plant are nice guys instead. This is, you know, who knew? But I also don't think they were sinister and they sat around a table and said, here's how we'll really screw over the blues artists. You know what I mean? Like, because they did credit some of them on some of the other songs. I think they just thought, or just the back then, that's just how it was, you know? So I don't know. I mean, Danzig is a little bit more damning, though, because he'll just, like, cut out something out of a comic book and put it on his records. You know what I mean? But yeah. Then on the other hand, who distributes Def American now? Is that Warner?
Whoever, one of the big ones. Sony, because isn't Rick Rubin is, like, the something of Sony, the creative vice president?
A major label distributes Danzig 1 through 4. That's got the Danzig skull on it.
I don't think anybody is distributing Danzig 1 through 4, John. I think they're all long out of print, but
incorrect. They are technically in print, but they're not. They haven't been reissued. You can, as a matter of fact, and I know
the vinyl copies of the first four records are quite expensive.
Yeah, well, the vinyl isn't, but the CD is in print, and also you can get
you can find those anywhere used at a record store,
and you can get the songs on Spotify. So technically, it's still in print. If you can get it on Spotify, it's in print. In 2020.
Homie don't stream, John. Homie don't stream.
So the Danzig skull is all over that. I have to think that Sony or Warner or even Def American or Def American have by now licensed that image from Marvel, or else why the hell would Marvel just sue the hell out of them, you know?
Because whoever owned it, I don't know. Marvel's been changed hands so many times since the 70s, too. Who knows?
I don't know. I'm thinking that had this stuff not been licensed, somebody would have sued them at this point. You know what I mean? So, anyway,
we'll return to our regular scheduled program.
I would just like to say, Jesus Christ, you two.
Get a podcast. Get a room. Now Adam's going to spend – now Adam's chastising us. Now he's going to spend 15 minutes describing whatever Canadian band he's going to play.
Actually, no. I was working on my newsletter as you guys were doing that because I'm like, I have no participation in this.
In the middle of this or what?
Exactly, yes.
Race Against the Machine is going on tour this summer. Run the Jewels is opening. A lot of people are very excited. It starts in March and runs all the way through September. Are you guys excited to see Rage Against the Machine? Is Rage Against the Machine still emblematic of Rebellion, or is it just another corporate rock band? And Run the Jewels, they're still cool. That's what I'm saying. And are you going to go see Rage Against the Machine, or is that not your style?
I like them, but I'm not going to go see them because the tickets are going to be really expensive, and I'm on a budget.
Do you feel that's hypocritical of them, or is that just them doing what any band of this size has to do in 2020?
Well, like, that's kind of the tricky thing, because you know, like, you can't, to me, it seems unfair to ask people to spend, like, you know, over $100 on a ticket, and then they're going to be like, yeah, smash the establishment. You know, like, it does seem very hypocritical, but I don't really think that there's anything they can do about it, because they are playing a lot of, like, really big venues and festivals and stuff. Like, they're playing Madison Square Garden twice, you know? So I think it's
Ian MacKay show us that an artist can do something about it, though, Em?
Well, yeah, but like,
I know it's great, yeah.
More people know about Rage Against the Machine.
True. They probably are not going to do $80 shows.
That'd be great, but no.
So
sorry, I knocked the wind out of you. My fault.
No, it's good.
I'm really torn about this because it's coming pretty close to me. They're playing in Hamilton, which is
really not Toronto.
They might also be playing Toronto, but they're definitely playing Hamilton.
Closer.
And on the one hand, I just recently found in a box under my desk here, and John, this might be of particular interest to you. I have a VHS cassette tape here. That's the noise. I have a VHS cassette tape of Rage Against the Machine at Maple Leaf Gardens on November 29th, 1999, which was a show that I saw them play at. But the second show that's on this particular bootleg, John, is Rage at the Electric Factory in Philly on 8/12/96. Could you have been there?
No, I at that time I was anti Rage Against the Machine because I thought they were silly, and then I became a fan later on.
That said, do you want to buy this tape for $50?
Yes, mail to me, Adam, and I, my Nigerian friend will wire you the information.
Yeah, so so I mean, I don't know about this, like, because the going to that raid show when I was, I don't know, what was I, 19, 18, whatever I was in 99, like, it, that was a very big deal for me. Like, I remember, like, I loved that show. It was a crazy experience for me because, like, despite the fact that I was, like, in my later teen years, like, I had never seen a, I'd seen a ton of punk bands and stuff like that play, but I had never seen a band play at, like, a venue of that scale, and to a crowd that size that was just going crazy about it. And I remember being very affected kind of walking out of that show after they, you know, after they closed with, say, Killing in the Name of, and just having, like, the crowds just, like, spilling out onto the streets of Toronto chanting, you know, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. And I'm just, it was a big deal for me to see that. So there's a part of me that's, like, really ringing nostalgic about this, you know, despite all of the uninspiring Prophets of Rage shit that's happened since then. Right. But just thinking back to that, I'm like, wow, like, do I want to go see this? Because, you know, even though it's, I mean, seeing Run the Jewels would be great. So that kind of, like, makes it all work. But I'm worried that it's going to be full of rock bros, right? Like full of, I don't know who Rage's audience is right
Who's
now.
Who's that senator from, was it a senator from, like, Paul Ryan, right? Paul Ryan was a big Rage Against Machine fan. It's going to be full of Paul Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. Like, like, I feel that, like as a teenager seeing Rage, I felt this, you know, you felt a certain kinship that at least the people that are there at this show are somewhat aware of the band's politics. At least I was hyper aware of the band's politics at the time. So I project that everyone else was aware of the band's politics, and that's why they were there. I feel that if I went to that show now, it would be a lot of, like, you know, like, big dudes in ball caps that are there for the nostalgia trip and not there because that was a band that they gave any shit about what they were saying. And I mean, that might have been true back in 99, but I think I would be distracted by it now. And I don't know if it's worth the ticket price for me to go and then to look around and be like, oh, I don't like any of these people.
Well, I'm going to use the machine against Rage Against the Machine because I want to see Run the Jewels, and I still haven't seen Run the Jewels yet. And so tickets are very expensive. However, they are playing it'll always be the E Center to me, the big outdoor arena in Camden right next to Philadelphia. And so I'm going to wait till the week of the show when ticket prices, you know, lawn prices drop from 70 to 10 bucks, and I will Rage Against the Machine myself.
That's
so, Adam, what night is the Hamilton show? What night of the week? Did you notice or no?
I will tell you.
Because the Detroit show is on a Monday. And I am not going to Detroit on a Monday and spending a bunch of money, but I think it's only like an hour further to go to Hamilton, maybe 2 hours.
And if it was on a weekend, is it Tuesday, the 21st.
Ugh, that's even worse. Right? I was going to say my strong American dollar goes a long way against your crappy Canadian dollar.
Yeah, that's true. So, John,
the $12 beers at the show will only be like $9.
That's a good way to experience Canada is to drink arena beers at the First Ontario Center.
Hey, I'll give Labatt's or something.
That's an amusing thing in my life is, like, we'll go see Sabres games in Buffalo, and I'm pretty sure, like, Labatt's is the beer of sponsor of the arena or whatever. So you can go get these, like, hilariously, like, strangely large tall cans of blue. Which is not something that we would, like, normally go out of our way to drink because it's crap, but, you know, you're there, so you do it. And it was always weird to me that, like, that is, you know, one of these beers that is, like, the Canadian beer, but you can only get it in this, like hilariously massive quantity at the American Hockey Arena. But anyways, I digress. John, the show that I was at in 99, two openers for it, neither of which I knew anything about at the time, but was interesting to see them both. The one was Gangstar.
Oh, actually, I saw not Mos Def. Who's the other guy in Gangstar? Talib Kweli. And honestly, he's pretty boring. But I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
And the other was and this is just a point of trivia. It's not something you're going to be impressed with, John. But the other was a band that I thought was totally terrifying and horrible, but was visually very interesting to watch because they all had like gigantic afros at the time. But it was At the Drive-In, and it was like At the Drive-In pre anyone giving a shit about At the Drive-In, and it just.
I still don't give a shit about the band.
Well, like I don't either. But there was, I feel like I went to that show and I watched that band play, and I was like, "Who the fuck was this?" And then it was like several years later where I realized, "Oh, that was At the Drive-In, like way before anyone cared." Okay, thank you.
Punk rock bowling headliner.
Well, anyways, Em, I believe you have a song. What song would you like to play for the listeners?
It's called "Where Did I Go Last Night." And it's by Bad Waitress from Toronto.
Driving down the road, I got a fever. I'm looking like a deer in the headlights, red lights. Where did I go last night? Did I get in a fight? Was I getting in some shite? Was it all right? Where did I go last night? Was it near? Was it far? Was I stuck inside a bar or doing whales? Where did I go last night? Yeah, I really need to know. Cause I woke up in a snowbank so blank. Where did I go last night? Yeah, tell me, please. Cause I bruised up on my knees and I lost my glasses. Where did I go last night? Where did I go last night? Please tell me. Where did I go last night? Where did I go last night? Please tell me. Where did I go? Seems that every time I say I'll stick around for one, that liquor creeps right up inside and says, girl, let's have some fun. Then that one it turns soon quick to two and it rattles up my mind. And I find myself waking up in a place where the sun don't shine.
And that was Bad Waitress. Adam, you mentioned them once before, didn't you?
I mentioned lots of stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, what was another cool Canadian band? And bringing us the underground stuff for you, the listener, to enjoy and learn about. Let's do three quick stories. I'm going to do an audible and throw one in the front because I want to talk about the last one last. I'm going to do this one in the front. Green Day, they released a new video. The video, it came with – the video stars one of the kids from Stranger Things. And the song is called Meet Me on the Roof. And I got to say, I'm going to surprise the listeners. I dug this song. I thought this song was actually like a pretty good song, only because I have no special affiliation with Green Day. I don't really care about Green Day one way or another. And I don't think this song is a rock song, but it's just kind of like a pop song you would hear on the radio. I thought it was cute and nice, and I thought it was kind of catchy. I'm not going to lie. I thought it was overproduced, but everything's overproduced these days.
I didn't listen to it. I'll take your word for it.
That's the level of prep that we want to demonstrate to Em on
Em, when I was brand new and I was on my first, I listened to everything. I was like studied up on everything and I knew what I wanted to say. And now it's just like, you know, I might put pants on.
I have like 3 pages of notes.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Don't do it.
Well, Em, tell us with your notes. What was your opinion of the Green Day video? What's your opinion of Stranger Things? And also, the kids in Stranger Things, they're kind of not kids anymore. They warmed America and Canada's heart with their youthful naivete, but now that they're becoming young adults, will they have trouble surpassing what they once used to gain the trust and love of North Americans?
As uncute as they were as kids, they're even worse as teenagers, aren't they?
Well, puberty's always rough.
It's
worse when like everyone's watching you, you know. Like, oof, can't imagine. Like, I like Green Day. They have a special place in my heart. The first song that I ever like really liked was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. And I didn't like this song, Like, I like how they're trying to be
different. I knew different. You had better taste than you have.
this is the thing. Like, I want to like it, but, like, I can't. You know, I've tried. I've given it a good go, but it doesn't, like, something's not clicking. You know, like, I like how they're doing something different and, like, completely, like, off the wall and, like, unexpected. You know, like, I like that, so I support that, but it's really catchy. It just, this song didn't do it for me at all. And, like, the video is, like, cute and sweet and stuff, but, like, there's a time and a place for that, and I don't know. It didn't really, like, add up to me.
Fair enough. Adam White, Green Day, where do you stand on the battle?
I shit all over the last single from this. For the usual reasons where I think that, like, they sound old and, like, they're at some level trying too hard, but at another level not trying hard enough. And they've just ended up in this weird middle ground where they don't particularly sound like Green Day too much right now. And I'm not exactly sure who they're trying to appeal to. And I don't feel that they or any of this group of, like, pop punk, pop rock bands that are all hanging out together right now are, I don't know, they're not accepting their age all that well. This same criticism applies to Weezer. Now, this to me is, like, maybe the least egregious of the recent Green Day stuff. It's a fairly inoffensive song. It's just not really a distinctive Green Day song. The video is cute. I like seeing all the Stranger Kids things when they show up. So long as they're not.
You just call it Stranger Kids things.
I call it Stranger Kids things, whatever the fuck they are. Like, what's this guy's name who is in here? Gaten Matarazzo, I guess.
The kid with the weird teeth or whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that I like that guy. He's adorable. So seeing him in this is totally fine and fun. And the video is inoffensive and heartwarming and all that stuff, and that's great. I mean, it's nice to see someone other than Finn Wolfhard show up in a bunch of band videos, because I guess, like, pop has already claimed him. So so, you know, I don't have any problem with that, but it does feed into the narrative of where I don't think that, like, Green Day, I feel like Green Day is making, like, boring non rock and roll strategic decisions about what they need to do to remain relevant. And I can totally see them sitting around the boardroom table and going, like, what are kids like these days? Give me one of those Stranger Kids things. Right. And bring in one of them in.
Adam so, White.
Yeah.
You're at the barber. You're getting your hair cut. This song comes on. You don't know that it's Green Day. Do you demand that your barber change the channel? Or are you like, yeah, man, this is haircut music.
My barber is angry, and I don't demand anything of him, John. It's a relationship where I am not a person of power, and I don't have scissors. So,
well, fair enough. Well, listen. Speaking of unfortunate situations, it was a big fire this past week. One of the world's only two lacquer manufacturer plants caught on fire and was destroyed. Apollo Masters, which was located in Bannon, California, was completely destroyed. They don't know what they're going to do, meaning there's only one factory that produces lacquer, which is necessary to make vinyl records. Now, as I was poking around, that claim might be somewhat untrue, that yes, that's the only factory that does it, but there are other producers that make it somehow. Also, other plants, well, one plant that one record pressing that really annoys me was like, well, actually, we don't use record lacquer, so it's not going to affect us. So all you mom and pop record stores, you guys are trash. But what's
the label that you've publicly attacked on the show before? I believe.
Oh, man. They more and more, they're at the point where they get under. No matter what they do, they're going to get under my skin. You know what I mean? But the point, and actually, I learned some disheartening facts about them. But getting back on track. According to the Pitchfork article, it's the end of the world and records are going to be delayed an insane amount. I think that's probably overstating it. But that being said, this is sad. And if the vinyl record industry is this fragile and that there's really only two suppliers for a necessary part of the record, does that mean that records that you know, for the past 3 or 4 years, we've been reading these articles, the record industry, it's back. You know, everyone loves records. But there's only two plants that can make a necessary part of the record. Maybe it's not as stable or as roaring as these obviously pro vinyl record articles would have you believe. You know what I mean? Like, if there's only like two plants that make tires for cars, then there must not be that big of a demand for cars. You know,
the weird thing is that, like, I kind of like how fucked up it all is. Because you hear stories all the time where, like, you're like, oh, we had to go into like the jungles of Brazil to find the one last record pressing plant where there was like one old man that knew how to run the machine, so we could bring him to New Jersey and have him like train a whole new crop of people. Like, you hear all this crazy shit like that still, and stories like this where all of a sudden there's like one crucial part of the process that is, you know, a small disaster away from falling all apart. And like, as a collector, I guess I kind of like it. I mean, I feel like, it would be,
you like that an entire industry and people involved in it are now out of the job.
I like that this whole thing is still sort of like predicated on real world constraints. And it's not just like, oh, records are back. So Walmart made 700 record factories in conjunction with Amazon, and now we're just pumping out copies of Tusk like no one's business, right?
Well, Walmart has like 100 records, Adam. I mean, they don't have a huge amount of records.
I don't like how weird it is. I like the whole industry is strange. And
but I mean, do you remember a few years ago they were talking about, oh, we can't keep up with demand? Well, you don't hear that anymore.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Tom, I'm glad you said that. And Adam, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'll let you continue.
It's caught up. They're caught up. Is this just a new thing to jack up the prices?
That demand thing was extremely overstated. And certain pressing plants that felt as though they had very low demand line, you know, wait times, issued news articles or things that said, oh, small plants, they're so backed up. They're back up 9 months, 12 months. Some records were delayed that amount. But see how many people you can actually find that had the record delayed 9 months. To a degree, that was negative commercial warfare, if you will, and it wasn't true. I mean, there was delays, but not nearly to the extent that certain people said there was.
The biggest problem I can tell right now is actually the distribution system. There's only one big company that does 90% of the distribution. Yeah. That's where the logjam is now. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Adam.
No, I mean, just I don't know.
I aren't even talking about Danzig, and we're dominating the conversation.
I'm just sort of fascinated by how it is still predicated on like a handful of relatively small businesses that all seem to be, you know, just maintaining the, you know, just maintaining like some semblance of normalcy at all times. And I mean, this applies sort of to all levels of it. I mean, we had one, and I can't remember the name of them right now, but there was like one of the big distributors that distributed a lot of the vinyl in Canada went out of business a couple of years ago. And like that severely screwed up the way that everything was moving around up here. And now, again, I'm not relishing this. A lot of people didn't get, a lot of like labels and stuff like that didn't get paid, but just it's interesting to me as an observer to see how this is not by any means a mature industry. It is very much, you know, kind of like on all levels, still this ramshackle thing that's sort of like held together by like enthusiasts and believers and this and that. And this is the kind of like crazy shit that happens in that kind of world. So, you know, I'm not, you know, relishing the fact that someone's not going to get their product as quickly as they could have. But, you know, I am going to step back and at least appreciate that, like, that this is not a mature baked in industry at this point, and that is a point of interest to me.
And are you dancing on the grave of Apollo Masters with Adam White, or do you have an ounce of sympathy?
She started the fire. She'll take it one step further. She's the
or did Ricky Frankel start the fire?
Ooh, the frame Ricky thing. Well, I bet you that's going to be a lot of people aren't going to get that reference, John, but I do.
Go ahead, Emma. I'm sorry.
No, yeah, no problem. Well, I didn't know that there were only like two really big manufacturers. Like, I thought it was a really big like industry because it's been around for like ever, it seems, you know. So now it's just kind of like, well, are they going to like adapt or is it going to start like being phased out again? I've never listened to a vinyl record. I have friends who collect them and who have like the players and stuff, and they're really cool. CDs are really nice. I think we should go back more CDs.
Yeah.
Can play them in cars.
Yeah. Well,
John and I are both CD lovers too. Adam, he pisses on them and throws them out the window.
Why?
Em, you're quasi local to me. Do you want like 400 punk CDs in a box? Because like,
yes.
My God, over. They're yours.
You still on Discogs, Adam?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and he's selling his Slit CD, which is insane.
Do you do the make offer thing, or do you only do the? Do you have all your prices set?
I often do the make offer thing because
I'm just going to go through and every one of them offer 1 cent and then tell you who I am.
I'm just going to be that guy that nails you on shipping. It'll be like 10 bucks shipping.
Yeah,
be like,
no. Canadian shipping. You don't have to nail me. It's like $14 a CD. Yeah.
Well, listen, we've got while these people argue about their shipping costs, we've got one last story, which is very important to me. Rudimentary Peni, of course, is one of the all time greatest anarcho-punk / death rock band, arguably the first death rock band. Well, I guess Bauhaus is before them, but it's Bauhaus. Well, whatever. Doesn't matter. Anyways, Rudimentary Peni is amazing. There's three guys in Rudimentary Peni, the guitar player and singer, and one of the main lyricists is Nick Blinko. Nick Blinko is also famous for his art, and if you look at the Rudimentary Peni records, his art is on them, and he's sometimes called what's called an outsider artist, which is an artist that, I guess, learned art outside of traditional schooling methods. That actually doesn't really apply to Nick Blinko because he did go to art school. And one time when he was asked about being an outside artist, he got kind of offended and he said, well, I don't consider myself an outsider artist. I consider myself an artist, which I thought was a good answer. One of the other interesting things about Nick Blinko is Nick Blinko is a very special individual. And for a long while, he had severe mental health issues. And for a long while, possibly decades, he didn't go outside of his house. And so I believe there's only four interviews with Nick Blinko, and there's about three or four pictures of Nick Blinko, and there's no live videos of him aside from some very grainy bootleg video shot of the Rudimentary Peni 1993 reunion tour. I think it was 1993. And that's it. Then out of the blue, just this past week, a short clip of Nick Blinko appeared on Instagram, and it was in Serbian, and so no one knew what it said. Well, as it turns out, Nick Blinko is the grand prize winner of the Triennial of Self-Taught Visionary Art at Serbia's Museum of Naive and Marginal Art. So basically, their outsider art museum. And so, I mean, no one's seen video of Nick Blinko for decades. We haven't seen a new picture of him in at least 15 years, and then all of a sudden there's this Instagram picture of him a French individual won the Lifetime Achievement Award. To me, this is cool because Nick Blinko is winning the Grand Prize Award, which means he's not getting awarded because he's done a lot in the past. He's winning because he's still the champ at doing, you know, his very unique style of art. And so I highly recommend you guys go on Punk News and see the very short clip. And because no one really knows what he looks like right now because he's changed how he looks over the years to a degree. And so I'm watching this video, and I think the video was the guy in the suit. And then all of a sudden, this guy who's standing in the background walks out, and he's like, my psychiatrist says I was always very naive. It's always nice to have a second opinion. And then he walks away, and while he's talking, like, he moves his head in, I guess, an unusual fashion, and he's standing like Patton, with his hands clasped behind his back, and he's got, and like everyone's wearing a suit, and he's got on kind of like a general issue t-shirt and pants, and these heavy ass like fishing boots, and I'm so happy that Nick Blinko is getting out of the house and that he's winning awards, and it seems like he's having fun, but I'm so happy that he's so uniquely him, and that he really is an odd individual, and I mean that in the best possible way. He's perfect. He's perfect. He's perfect. I love this video.
John, you sell it so convincingly. I wish I had watched it.
Adam, did you watch this video?
Nope, John. You're the only one who is.
I watched it.
And what did you think of Nick Blinko in his first public appearance in decades?
I didn't know who was going to come forward, too. So it's like kind of surprising. And then when I Googled him, there was just like that one picture that came up. So it was really interesting. And I did a lot of research on this because I knew nothing about it. So it's really interesting. It's really cool to see him like be honored for something that he obviously like really likes to do and, you know, gives him. Like some respite and stuff.
Well, Em, thank you for putting Tom and Adam to shame. Because they should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves for not watching the first Nick Blinko video in decades. This is Nick Blinko. This ain't, you know, I don't know, Left Alone. It's not Pears. It's Rudimentary Peni Boys. The band. T-H-E band. So, I don't know what to say. Somebody play a song so I can come back and berate these two some more.
And we will just crush the enthusiasm out of you for having to put up with John's nonsense soon enough.
Never.
All right, Tom, do you want to play anything? Are you
I gladly will play a song. I've been really slacking on playing songs.
Do it.
But I would gladly play a nice old punk rock song for y'all. A friend of mine in Indiana has reissued the Sloppy Seconds Live album, which came out originally in 95, 25 years old. He's putting out a vinyl for the first time. Why don't we play a track from that? That will be good fun. Let's do, so the name of the album is Sloppy Seconds Live, No Time for Tuning. Let's play Steal Your Beer.
This next one is all about uninvited house guests. Ace Hardware.
And that was Sloppy Seconds. I've got the reissue. The reissue, honestly, if you got the CD or the record, like I definitely like CDs better than records. But the record of this one album actually sounds a lot better on record because the CD had like a lot of white noise, and so the record makes it sound a lot better.
What color did you get, Johnny? What color?
Purple. I think. Let me look. I don't know.
It's got to be green or clear.
I got green then. I don't really worry about that kind of thing too much.
No, but they only did the mail order one. They only did clear and the Al testicles green.
That's what I got. I got the testicle green.
So, there you go.
Anyways, you can always reach the podcast at punknews.org. Adam White, and any final words for the listeners?
There's a record show on Sunday and my wife's working, so I have to decide if I'm going there and bringing two kids with me or not. And I don't know, listeners, what do I do?
On a side note, Adam, I was at a record convention last Sunday. And this dude had his baby, like a baby with him, like a baby in the carrier. And he put it down like right in front of my feet. I'm like, I don't want to be a dick. But Adam,
John, don't step on a baby, man.
No, but I'm like, this dude.
He wasn't going to step on it. He was going to kick it.
He put it right
by. Just like a drop kick.
Like, is that very irresponsible, Adam? Or when you have a kid, like, you just get so used to it, like, you don't even worry about that kind of thing?
No, he looked at you, John, and he said, this is a responsible man that I can set my baby down in front of you.
Well, honestly, he was very complimented. I think he was using his baby to, like, get in front of the records. And like, I was flipping through him, and he puts the baby right in front of my feet, and then he starts leaning over in the box that I'm in. You know what I mean?
That's, on the one hand, that's a really good move, and I wish I would have used my children for that. On the other hand, I maybe naively go through life assuming people aren't going to try to step on my children, so you shouldn't do that.
So you would put them in...
But you know what? Honestly...
You put your baby in front of a stranger's feet. You would do that.
Well, that's not because it's kind of a dicky thing to do, but on the other hand, I would still remain fairly convinced that you would not step on a baby.
That baby was 100% safe, John. This guy essentially had like a 15 pounds of injection molded plastic mace. He could have just whacked you over the head with it.
I just don't know what, like, I just was insulted that he would dare to use his baby as a tool. You know what I mean? Like, I would think that, he put his baby.
That guy was arm deep in shit for the other 90% of his day. So the one time that baby is going to be useful to him, he's going to take it, and I applaud him.
So I should have called Child Protective Services on him then, huh?
You should have just stepped out of his way and said, sir, you have a worse thing going on than I do.
Nowadays, if you want people to get out of the way when you're shopping for records in the day of the coronavirus, you just cough this really wet, like hacking cough, and you will have the whole like A through C section to yourself.
And more, wonderful to have you on the podcast. Anything you want the listeners to know, anything you want them to check out, any parting words for the group till next time?
Thank you very much for this opportunity. It's really, really fun, really like interesting and like, good to talk about things.
You were an injection of youth that our old bones really needed. It was nice.
Well, once again, thanks for listening, and you can always use that podcast at punknews.org, and we will see you next week.